Episode of the Full Tank Motorcycle Podcast. It's me, Rob, from the YouTube channel Moto Bob, and I'm joined as always by Tim. How are things, mate?
Not too bad. I'm hating the rain at the moment. Got caught in some hail yesterday, which was great fun, but otherwise I'm fine. How are you?
Similar. Getting a lot of a mix of weather, but generally good. And we've got such a, well, a very exciting bunch of press bikes showing up over the next few weeks. So next week it's the MT09. Then I've got the Himalayan 450. Then I've got the 990 Duke, 1390 Duke, Tenere Explore. Oh, there's something else as well, mate. Vitpillen 401. And then I've also got the XSR 900 GP lined up. Things are really shaping up this year. Now the weather's getting good.
That's quite a lot. Yeah, no, yeah. Hopefully you get the good weather to actually use them. Have you still got the Svartpillen, or has that gone
That's
back?
More like a sort of semi-long-termer. So we'll be doing quite a bit on that in between. But yeah, very busy with just like amazing bikes. And the MT09, one of my favorite bikes already. So I hope this new 2024 one is as good, if not a little bit better. So yeah, we'll definitely have to get you over for one of those, maybe to, you know, sample the delights of some of the great press bikes we've got coming. Anything tickle you fancy out of that list?
I think the KTMs sound, yeah, exciting to me. A little bit out of the norm from what I tend to ride. So yeah, definitely looking forward to them.
Anyway, as usual, we got a selection of some of the best motorcycle news stories this week to get through, as well as comment of the week and a very, very tasty bike of the week to wrap things up. But first up, we'll dive in with the new announcement of the Metzler Rotec Zero 2s, which was out on the launch of last week in the Isle of Man. I felt very lucky to be there. You've been before as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I went for, it was my dad's 60th, and we went for the Manx Grand Prix.
You were just sort of alluding to the fact that we haven't had the best weather lately. And I think if you're searching for good weather, the Isle of Man isn't the place to go. It's like a tumultuous microclimate. What was it like when you were there?
Yeah, it was a mix, not going to lie. I think we skirted the worst of it, really. I mean, basically, there was a couple of sort of heavy showers, but we made sure we were in a pub at that time, having 0% alcohol. Guinness, which I discovered there for the first time, which was another nice thing
This is something we share a bit of a love of, isn't it? That 0%
Yeah, it's
Guinness.
Really good. But also, when you're out on the Isle of Man and you're out riding your bike, it's the social thing. You know, we were, it was brother and father kind of like bonding time. It was really fun. You want to have a drink, and everyone else is having a drink, and I'm pretty sure a lot of them weren't doing 0%, but you're like, it's, they contradict, they're in conflict with each other. You want to have a drink, but you also want to ride, and they don't really mix very well. So having the 0% was great, and then you just sit down, watch the bikes go past. There wasn't any racing, I take it, when you were there?
Oh, just me, mate. Probably setting a lap record unintentionally on the Honda NT1100 shod with the new Metzler Rotec Zero 2s. Nah, I think it's a really good point on the 0% stuff. I just don't really like soft drinks that much sometimes. You like want something savoury almost, which I think Guinness definitely is. So it's it's quite a nice little mid-ride treat. But yeah, we had absolutely all the weather as well. And at one point, they closed off the mountain.
Yes.
There was a 10-mile section to do some photo passes where people were allowed to go a bit quicker, you know, do a wheelie or two, cross over the racing line as well. In fact, I believe it's called the Gooseneck, right? Famous corner. And then there was another one up at the top that was famous as well. But we just set off and I went round the outside of the corner. And then on the way back down, the photographer was gesturing at me like, we've got another pass. He's like, take the racing line. It's obviously going to look way better.
Yeah.
But it was just not my instinct. It feels really weird,
Makes sense.
When the road's closed off and you can just use the whole road.
Yeah.
Just going around a blind bend on the wrong side of the road and you're like, is it closed though? Like, is it definitely, definitely, definitely closed?
Yeah.
There's nobody coming the other way with a memory card or something.
Everything in your habit and that's ingrained in you is to say, don't do that. Yeah. I really liked it though, to be honest. It was as weird as I kind of hoped it to be on the circuit that I tend to watch it every year because I like the Isle of Man. It's one of my favourites to watch. And I think they shoot it really well because obviously it's done after the fact. They don't do like a live race. So they manage to sort of keep the interest as you're watching. And it was really cool to be on the track that I've seen. But even more cool was when we were there, you'd go round it literally sort of 10 minutes before they're going to be on it racing, and you're on there up until they close it on the wire, and wherever you get to, whatever sort of pub you've landed at or spot you've landed at, that's where you have to just park up and pitch up until the racing's done. And you can watch people go round the roads that you've just done at much faster speeds. And one of the weird things from that, though, I do remember thinking, like, if someone's been going around there with, like, an old Triumph, and there was a lot of old bikes, with, like, an old Triumph or a Harley or something, and it's just dobbing oil on the road, there's no way of, like, managing that. I know they go around and test it before they go out and properly spin up, but, it's weird. You can't get that anywhere else.
Are you sort of questioning the responsibility of some of the classic bike owners or...
No, I think it's a natural thing. Actually, I say that like I've got the higher ground. My Ducati has a very small oil leak as well. So it could have been me. Who knows? But, you know, I don't want to be responsible for somebody going through with the oil. But, yeah, it was good. It was good to do the roads anyway.
We didn't have any of that. We just had a lot of, there's a lot of traffic, I suppose, especially around the sort of busier parts of the island. But we did a loop at the bottom of the island, which isn't part of the route, of course. That was in the morning. Mm. But it's actually quite spectacular. I really want to go back and do a bit more riding there. And then we did the north, where it's more of the TT route, in the afternoon. But yeah, we got such a mix of weather. I was going to say as well, on that TT route where they closed it off, the first bit with the gooseneck where I was going around the outside of the bend was clear. And then we got a little bit higher and it started to get really misty and foggy, which I believe is fairly common occurrence there. Yeah. And then did you go to the Victory Cafe?
Yes. Yeah,
such a cool place, isn't it? Yeah. Amazing little spot. Very nicely done. Great food. Has like a cool little store as well with some clothing and things like that. I really want to go back there as well.
Yeah.
The fog just came in. And honestly, coming down the mountain road, which should have been the most exciting thing, you could only see about 5 meters in front of you. Mm. And I was behind a lead rider in a fluo jacket. And I was thinking, well, as long as I can see him, I'll know roughly where the road goes. Yeah. But then he started inching away from me. And I was like, ugh.
Right. I've never been in such... So you've either got to go fast and keep up with him, or you've got to just sort of give in. Yeah.
Totally. And it's not like going down the motorway. Like, this is a road that's specifically, you know, famous for being banging for racing on and stuff.
Yeah.
And actually got to the point where it was a little bit like, you know, old driving computer games, Mega Drive and things like that, where you just have a short section of road in front of you. The car's not actually, doesn't really feel like it's moving. And the road's sort of coming towards you. And you can only see, it doesn't have like a particularly...
Yeah, so the draw distance wasn't good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
It was a bit like
the draw
that.
Distance
sketchy.
Went retro gaming style, yeah.
Yes, but you got to say, if you're going to go and test the sports touring tyre, probably having a mix of everything is pretty good. So it did rain heavily the day before, so we had wet roads in the morning. Glorious sunshine for a bit. A bit of like wind. It was all buffety and then up into the fog and the damp roads. Some warm tarmac in the morning. Then it got quite cold. Mm. And it was actually pretty good in all of them. And we had a great selection of bikes to ride them on. I was on the MV Turismo Veloce, which I picked first because I just kind of thought, let's go with the fancy bike straight away. Yeah. You kind of had to just run to the bike you wanted in the morning and put your helmet on.
Like
it,
a racing start, like a proper...
A little bit, yeah.
What is it? Not a GT start or something, but yeah.
Like a Le Mans start.
Le Mans start, sorry. Yeah, run up to the bike, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty much. And then I went on to the Suzuki GSX A-Test to get like a naked thing. And then there was a Honda NT1100 in the afternoon. And that was when the weather started to get bad. So I just sat on that all afternoon. Weirdly, hated the MV Agusta after a while. Like, I think it's got the smart clutch, you know, the recluse clutch where it bites. It's a mechanical kind of twist and go clutch. So at a standstill, it just disengages when you twist the throttle. You just pull away, but I just found it a little bit jerky, and also I'm not sure how it affects like mid-corner when you just crack the throttle. Like, it just didn't feel that predictable. Love the Suzuki, but I felt most confident on the NT1100, which was kind of interesting. I was going quicker than any of the other bikes on that bike, which you wouldn't necessarily say was particularly sporty looking. Had a great time on it. But the tyre, mate, as well, I mean, when you get to the end of a day like that and you think, I haven't had any moments... It hasn't really kind of crossed my consciousness that much about the tyre.
Yeah.
It just kind of performed in every area. Then you think it's probably pretty good. It's got obviously big, quite thick treads for the sport, you know, sports touring. They found it was like the previous Road Techo one was a sports touring tyre. that did the wet stuff and the stability quite well. So getting pushing the water away for riding in the wet, good warm-up times, and then a hard-wearing strip in the middle that's stable at speed and you know, gives you decent mileage. They found in their research, like, more customers want to do the sporty riding more. So what they did was reduce the amount of tread. So it looks more like a sporty tire. There's fewer of them, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Lateral on the shoulders, longitudinal grooves to get the water away. Yeah. But then what happens when you start riding quicker? Obviously, like, if it's dry and you start pushing it like a sporty tire, these big fat grooves, like, there's enough movement in the tire so that they can just close up. Does that make sense? And then you've effectively got much more surface area.
Right. Is that like the tension of the rubber or something?
Yeah. So then you don't have these big wet weather grooves in the tire. They're calling it adaptive tread.
That's, yeah, quite clever.
Yeah, it is smart.
Did it? I mean, could you feel a difference? I guess for me, if it's a good tire, same as you say, right? It just needs to get out of your way. It needs to be something you don't even think about. So
yeah,
I think is the sign of a good tire to me is one that I feel comfortable on because I just don't even think about it. I just think about my line or placement in a corner.
I think when you say, can you feel a difference? They didn't have Roteco 1s or competitor tires to ride them against.
Sure.
So it's a little bit tricky in that regard. But I think what you would probably find with the previous Roteco 1 is, like, it was perfectly good when we were doing the wet weather stuff. But then in the afternoon, there was, let's say, about half an hour of riding to the start of where the road was closed. And we were getting a decent lick on. And, like, I was on a fairly large bike, the NT1100, that isn't particularly low slung. And I think probably when you started pushing that sort of bike on sports touring tires that were a little bit more biased towards the wet and stuff, you might start to feel a bit nervous on some of the corners as you start to kind of get a bit of more lean on. And, you know, would you see ABS or TC kicking in more frequently if they don't have all that surface area, for example? Genuinely, I felt like you could push the tire quite far considering what you'd expect from that sort of tire. So I think that probably is the big positive out of it. But it was an amazing trip. And we also went to the TT launch party for the race. So that was tied in because Metzler sponsor the TT now.
Hello.
And so it was their big showcase, get all the riders up on stage and interview them and stuff.
And obviously you're a big fan of the riders, so I'm sure you knew all the names. And did you get some signatures? How did you play that?
At the London Motorcycle Show, we sat and had a coffee and you were like, OMG, that's Michael Dunlop sat next to us. And I was trying to chat to you.
Yeah. Oh, mate.
Do you remember? I was just like, okay. And then I was like, but what about this video that we're trying to make today? And I'm always like very focused on those days where we're shooting stuff.
Sure.
But obviously at the TT announcement, he was the last person they interviewed as like the, you know, the headline act, if you will. And they were streaming it out to everyone on YouTube. And it was a really like well-produced affair, let's say, you know, it had full camera crew. Like three presenters, all lighting, big stage, loads of bikes around to look at, big crowd that got invited. But it all went over my head, but it was still cool to be there. Had a couple of beers, enjoyed it.
Had some nibbles, had some beers, all good.
I was more like fanboy of the tire than, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Most people were excited to be there. I was like, can't wait to get to ride all these bikes tomorrow. Try out the new tire and make a good video. But I still enjoyed being there and seeing it all. And I do kind of understand a bit more about it now, which was quite cool. Getting to the sort of hype for this year. Also, shout out a couple of Motobob viewers at the TT launch. So it's great to like say hello to people. I don't think they went specifically to see me. It was probably...
I was going to say, when did you get on the stage?
No, but genuinely, a couple of people came up and said hello, which I think was really cool. I enjoy it when people do that. If it was like a festival poster, you know, headline acts, you Michael Dunlop's at the top in biggest font, Motobob would be right at the bottom of the page in, you know, that section where it's just like 2-point font.
Terms and conditions.
Yeah, it's in the terms. Anyway, moving swiftly on, it was a thoroughly enjoyable time. And I do recommend checking out the full video about the Metzler Roteco 2s that will be on the main channel. But I also pulled out a couple of new stories to look at this week. And one, this is from Cycle World. They're really good at picking up some of the patents and trademarks and stuff like that. Basically, this is the idea that Zero are working on what they're calling a simulated clutch. So one of the things about electric bikes is they can be, and I think the same for dual clutch bikes and things like that as well, actually, they can be a little bit abrupt when you're riding at lower speeds. And so the idea of this is to fit a clutch lever to the electric bike, but it's not actually connected to a physical clutch component. It just feeds into the bike's electronics, and it delivers the power in a way that you'd possibly expect a traditional clutch to behave on an internal combustion bike. So let's say you've given it half throttle, but you've also given it half clutch. It's going to deliver that amount of power to maybe help you kind of dial in that smoother riding. Now, I don't know if you found this on electric bikes, but they can be a bit jerky, let's say.
Yes. Yeah. And I think they've improved through the iterations that I've tried even. I haven't been on one for a while, actually, but the ones that I tried, there was an improvement. You could see the progression of it through the different bikes that I went on. So, yeah, it takes some finesse, let's put it that way. It's definitely different. You can't just jump on it and expect it to feel like it would with the petrol, yeah.
But, you know, if you think about a petrol bike, what's the first way that you would add finesse to, let's say you had a passenger and they were particularly prone to getting seasick, and so you wanted to smooth things out, like you would always dip the clutch a bit when you're pulling away or that kind of thing. And that's a really good point as well. They have improved. I remember taking out the Zero DSR, which was their kind of semi off-road looking thing from right when they first launched their first bikes. And that was when none of them had traction control. And the dealer said, oh, we've had a few of those like go down the demo bike because people go out the dealer, slightly wet road, give it some throttle, and they can be quite abrupt. So for me, this might be a step in the right direction. But I don't know. What do you think? Could it bring more trad bikers, you know, people who like the mechanical satisfaction of riding? Do you think it will get them more interested in electric bikes, which, as we covered in the last episode, have really been dipping in terms of sales recently?
I don't know that it's going to do enough to convince traditional bikers to go that route. I think fundamentally it comes down to price for a lot of people. I think that would be the biggest way that you could improve that market. When it comes to whether or not this is like a good idea or I can see the use in it, I can kind of see both sides of the argument. It's a weird thing because the whole not having a clutch, not needing to use it, I suppose you don't need to use the clutch, is one of the USPs of having an electric bike, and that is almost a selling point in a way because it is quite a strange thing. So why try and imitate a petrol bike? But I can see the flip side of that argument being that I guess it wouldn't always be there. I'm sure you can just use it without it if you want to. It's not going to be sort of necessary. And it does, like you say, add some finesse to it. And I think that's true because I went out on the first time I went on an electric bike, I full throttled it coming out of a car park and had a bit of a moment on the rear and was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's what you're lacking, which you wouldn't get with a petrol because you'd obviously tease the clutch out a little bit more. So, yeah, I think it's a useful thing.
Useful thing, but it's probably not going to transform like people's perceptions of them.
The sales, no, probably not.
I believe you're right, by the way, that it wouldn't be mandatory. I don't think if you, for example, came to a standstill and let the clutch out, as if you're in first gear on a petrol bike, that the bike would jolt forward. I think it's very much like the smart clutch on MV Agustas that we just talked about, or maybe the new e-clutch from Honda, where it's twist and go, but you can dip the clutch to then cut some of that power to make it easier to use at lower speeds. What's also interesting, we're talking about this kind of practically and sensibly, in the way that you might dip it to go slower or smooth things out, and it's going to make your ride a little bit more refined and controllable, especially if you're used to a petrol bike. The flip side of it is it will work if you let it out quickly. And if you've ever tried to wheelie an electric bike, but...
Yeah, did I not just say, and I just had the race well, wake me up in the morning. It was good.
But they do kind of... if you try and snap the throttle, if you did it like a power wheelie, quite a lot of the time, they're built to, now that you, as you say, they've got more advanced, they're built to deliver it in kind of a usable way. And so it is quite difficult to get it to pop up. But I believe it will be ping, just let it out and it'll just pop the front, hopefully, if you've got the TC switched off. So stunt riders the world over. Well, eco-friendly stunt riders the world over can rejoice because their job might get a bit easier. Interesting one. I mean, yeah, I think I agree with you. I don't think it's going to transform sales or perceptions. But I also think that if I hopped onto an electric bike with a clutch like that, I'm probably going to feel just a bit more at home and like it
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever done that with an electric bike or a DCT bike or anything that doesn't have a clutch lever. When you're braking and coming to a stop, your hand goes like that, searching for the clutch lever.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as you sit on it, because obviously to start off as well, you're sort of like, oh, God, where is it going? Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, really weird thing.
Anyway, moving swiftly on to the next piece, I just picked this one up and it looks quite exciting to me. It's an Instagram post from the guy who is now the CEO of BMW Motorrad, or MD, Marcus Flash. I believe he came in fairly recently, but it's him, Marcus Flash's Instagram, 77.5k followers, so, you know, kind of a big deal. And he's teasing a sheet off the rear end of a new motorcycle, and his caption says, "There is something big coming." Then two boxing gloves, so it must be a boxer twin.
Mm. That makes sense.
That's like a, is that a Dingbats? Anyway, Boxer Twin, and then #DreamBike. But I don't know if you can, you know, pick apart what we're seeing here and the excitement on his face, but it looks like, realistically, this is going to be some kind of aggressive take on the BMW R18.
Mm. Yeah, that would be my guess. It looks quite raw. I don't know whether that's like they're designing it that way or if this is just because it's like early production. Because you can see the shaft drive on it, right?
Ah, so that's exposed. Actually true of the normal BMW R18. It has an exposed shaft drive, which feels a little bit scary if you're wearing a skirt or like a sarong or something. Like, you do think that's probably going to get wrapped up in there. Always recommend tight, tight trousers if you're riding pillion on a BMW R18. But I think I know what you mean. We were looking at the spy shots last week of that potential new street triple bike, and a lot of the parts were billet, weren't they? Because I guess they're prototyping different parts, swapping them out, testing how it handles and things like that. And this looks a little bit like it's just been, you know, milled from a solid piece there. So maybe that's the case. But also, if you look at the swing arm on the normal R18, it's kind of just fixed. It's quite simple. But you can see there's pivots on the top and bottom here. So it looks like it might be something that behaves in a different way. Perhaps something like a power lever design, which they use to eliminate that sort of shaft jacking kind of feel.
Yes.
Which makes me think...
I was going to use the term shaft jacking.
You love a bit of shaft jacking.
Yeah, no,
you're
I like it. It's a fun... Yeah, I remember the video. You did a little aside when you said shaft jacking, yeah.
Did I? No. Grow up, me. Yeah. But yeah, shaft jacking fans maybe won't be into this one. But if you are not somebody who likes shaft jacking, then this new sort of linkagey swing arm might actually improve how the bike feels. And then that's got me thinking, well, why were they happy with all of those different iterations of the R18? Just having that sort of much more simple swing arm design. And there was, you know, the R18 Classic, was it? And then they did the Bagger and the Transcontinental. Happy with that. But this one needs a more advanced swing arm design. And I can only think, because it's kind of like a hot version, which is what Visor Down as well are saying here, that they think it's like a spicy R18 that's going to take on stuff like the Rocket 3 and maybe something like the Harley Breakout. Maybe even, I don't know. I was going to say Ducati Diavel V4 as like a power cruiser, but I can't realistically see anybody thinking about a Diavel V4 thinking an R18 is in the same realm.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, you've got a sporty tire on the rear, which looks like a big fatty, and then also some kind of wheel design that, again, I'm not sure from a performance perspective. It's almost disc wheel with a few vents cut in it.
Yeah, but it's cool though.
Yeah, visually that feels like the rest of the bike is going to look quite mean. Yeah, yeah. So, assuming that they do give it a boost in power, they're probably going to give it some better brakes, better suspension. It's got this new swing arm design. Do you think an R18 has any chance of being as appealing as something like the Rocket 3? Which it's realistically going to be closest to, especially considering the new Rocket 3 Storm they updated the other week has a few more horses and a bit more torque.
Mm, interesting one. I think my gut feeling is that the Rocket is still going to perform better, because that one kind of, its form belies how actually performance-based it can be, and you don't feel like it sort of limits you at all. Unlike with the R18, from my understanding, because I haven't ridden it, obviously having fairly limited ground clearance, and it's not a sporty cruiser. I don't think it's going to be able to play with it in terms of carving, let's put it that way, but in terms of power, I'm sure. And the other thing is, I think BMW have the ability to do that. I just don't know whether they would with the R18.
Yeah, who knows? I don't think the R18's been massively selling that well. I just don't know if it hits the mark for the sort of Harley cruiser market that they were intending for. So it's really interesting they put all this extra development into a new variant of it. But maybe it is the one that will eventually start to appeal to a big audience. But I think I have to agree, when I've ridden the R18, it's felt heavy. I think it's heavier than some of the equivalent bikes as well. It's really long. And yeah, it just doesn't really feel like a quick bike, and maybe not that exciting to ride as well, you know, because of the sheer size of it and the weight of it.
Yeah.
The brakes have never been super sharp. The power, you know, it's got that mid-range and torquiness you'd expect from a big 1.8-litre boxer twin. It drives quite strongly, let's say. But it's not something you imagine as a aggressive, raw, sporty, power cruisery type bike. And so it feels like they got the work cut out to achieve it, but I'm certainly interested to see what they come up with. Maybe it will just be absolutely dripping. It could be the M18. Think about that, mate.
Okay.
You know, they've got the M1000RR, M1000R, M1000XR. Maybe this is the next one in the list. Anyway, super interested to see what they come up with. But next up, we've got comment of the week. Last week we were discussing the GSX ATAR, which is the sporty clip-on barred version of the Suzuki middleweight. And we were talking about the sales figures, the fact that it was selling really quite well. It was among some of the best sellers. When I'd experienced feedback from perhaps dealers that the 8S, the naked equivalent that was released last year, didn't actually sell that well. And we were trying to pick apart, well, why is the sporty version doing so much better than the naked version, or that's how it appears. Anyway, Rage Rider 6283 comes in with a little bit of first-hand experience and has commented with his rationale as to why he's actually gone and bought a GSX ATAR. So he said, I bought the 8R over the 8S, predominantly, let's say, the fairing. It's more versatile and it looks better in my opinion. I have to respectfully disagree that the 8S and Hornet look the same. They do not at all. The Hornet is a good bike, but it couldn't be more beige vanilla if it tried. It looks and feels much cheaper than the 8S, but it's only about £300 less. If you want like for like in terms of spec, you could say it has more bang for buck than the Suzuki with 8 horsepower more and 12 kilos less weight, but the Suzuki's extra torque more than compensates. So that's it. I think it probably just comes down to the fairing and how that gives it a little bit more wind protection and versatility.
Yeah.
And it does, I would agree, look quite a bit better, the 8R than the 8S. I think my theory was, the 8R is selling so much better because it doesn't have to go up against the Honda equivalent. To me, the Hornet looks like a tempting proposition. At least it's going to take some sales from the 8S, and there isn't like a CBR 750. That was our theory. But it sounds like Rage Rider's saying he would have gone for the 8S over the Hornet anyway, so maybe that's not really a factor. Mm. What about you, mate? Naked or a fared equivalent?
Well, I was like naked. I tend to exercise that right in the mornings quite a lot.
And then throughout the rest of the day.
Yeah, as much as I can actually get away with, yeah. I flip-flop. I really flip-flop. But at the moment, obviously, I have a naked bike and I really enjoy that one. But I think because it's set up in a sort of specific way, when I had my Hornet back in the day, I do remember the kind of riding position on that one because I was more upright. Was brutal if you're doing distance, whereas weirdly enough on the Monster, I think because you're lent forward, you kind of get away with it. So it kind of is based bike specific. It really depends on that specific bike and the kind of ergonomics of it. But owning the Africa Twin, yeah, I can see a massive benefit in having fairing, and even having like sort of half fairing or something a little bit smaller does make it a little bit easier to live with, certainly. So if you're going to ride a lot and you're not just taking it out for weekend fun, I think I'd probably err on the side of fair option as long as it does look good.
Especially this genre of sports bike we've got now, like the GSX ATAR, the Daytona 660, and I think those are probably the main ones. Maybe the Aprilia RS660 as well. It's not a handlebar position yes. that's like super, super aggressive. It's probably more similar to how your Monster is in that they are a little yes. bit sporty, a little bit forward, but not as low as like a Super Sport and not as sat up as a Naked. So probably they strike the right balance. They had the GSX ATAR at the Metzler launch as one of the options, but I intentionally didn't ride it because I want to put in like a good week and have like a full opinion before I even talk about it. I just didn't want to do like an hour or two or an hour, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like quite an exciting bike and one that people are keen on. So yeah, I'll do it justice, hopefully, with a press bike at some point this year. Anyway, thank you very much, Rage Rider, for your input on that one. And please do, everybody else, leave your comments on the YouTube version of this podcast and we'll try and feature some of the best in future comments of the week. And now it's time for a little look at this rather tasty bike of the week. Now, Tim, feast your eyes on this bad boy. And you just mentioned your Honda Horner, but did it look anything like this?
Yeah, it was exactly that. Yeah, not too far off. I mean, different coloured wheels, maybe. Yeah, that is, yeah, that's a heavy custom job. That every single part of that looks like it's been breathed on. I like the kind of Cyclops-esque eyeball headlight on it.
Yes.
Do you know what, that sort of weird winglet on the back, almost like a spoiler, but on a bike. That's quite cool.
You know what? I think sometimes people put like a retro cafe fairing and seat cover, like tail cover, on a modern-ish bike like this, and they're not congruous with the tank shape because they've used the original Hornet tank from the looks of things anyway here. And what I think that little lip on the tail cover there does is like themes it a bit with the tank shape and makes it all look like it ties together, together quite nicely.
Yeah, no, it does. It's I think it's given me sort of CB1300 vibes as well with a little kind of upscoop to it. But I think you're right. It's sort of, it matches the angle on the kind of the shoulder of the tank really well, which obviously we say about that kind of leading lines and matching them is a really good part of making a custom job look, like you say, congruous. Yeah,
he smashed it. Anyway, here's the rundown of how it's been built. So it's actually built by a part-timer, Sebastian Vernaison, in France. So you got to say, fitting that around your day job and stuff, it does look like a heck of a lot of work. Very impressive. Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed this, mate, but would you say France is, for me anyway, just anecdotally, seems to have a high output of like amazing custom bikes?
Yeah, I don't like to admit it because there's a bit of rivalry there, isn't
there? Is there?
Yeah, they really, well, you know, England, France, they're close. neighbors always fight. I begrudgingly kind of admit that, yeah, in terms of the custom scene, they are killing it. They've got some really good things. I think Bark Motorcycles are my kind of like one of my benchmarks for a company just doing next level custom jobs.
Annually as well, Honda do these build series where they give everybody they've done it with the Rebel, they've done it with the Monkeys and Groms. They do it for Wheels and Waves, which is a surfing and custom motorcycle festival down in Biarritz. They I don't know if they just give out the bikes or maybe fund the dealers and custom shops to do these specials, but I've covered it a few times, really enjoy seeing what people come up with. And I've noticed in that so many of the entrants are within France, so it seems like there's a really healthy custom scene there. Anyway, let's have a look at this bike. So we've already talked about the custom bodywork, so using the original tank, but putting on a belly pan, half fairing, little tail section. Lighting, there's Kellerman lights at the rear, which look really clean and minimal. Then it's got that one headlight off to the side on the front. You've got clip-on style handlebars, so it's going to make it feel a bit sportier to ride. Steering damper, quick turn throttle, Nissin brake and clutch levers. Koso dash, so it's got a custom speedo in there. Hyper Pro suspension, so both the fork and shock have been upgraded. Dunlop Sportmax tyres. There's an Arrow exhaust header mated to a Danmoto carbon silencer, which has had a bit of modification to make those two things fit and sit exactly right. Swing arm mounted license plate holder, grey paint, blue pinstripes, and blue on the wheels for an extra 10 horsepower. Looks absolutely fantastic, and it's got me kind of thinking, my SV is sort of this era, right? Like modernish looking, but a little bit dated almost now, sort of in that 20 years old category. Mate, this would be the dream to achieve something like this. It's never going to happen because I'm too busy making YouTube videos all the time. But it just shows what can be done with that era of bike, which can be picked up for, you know, how like BMW air-cooled boxers became a thing in the custom scene and the price of all the used ones went massive. What I love about this is it's taking a bike that you can probably pick up for like between $1,000 to $2,000 for a bit of a crummy old bike. But look how far you can take it with some skill and design flair and probably quite a lot of mechanical and technical know-how.
Yeah, I agree. I think, so my Hornet, actually, the guy that picked mine up was like, oh, I'm going to customize it. I have no idea if he did, and I can guarantee it didn't look as good as this one, whatever he was doing with it. But yeah, it's he's going to be gutted if he drops that helmet, I will say that much, because that matches his wheels absolutely perfectly. But yeah, I think you should go this sort of route and do that with yours, because like you say, the great thing is, if you're doing a custom job, it needs to start from a kind of a cheap and plentiful base so that, you know, spare parts are easy to find, actually getting the bike in the first place is easy to find, and so that enthusiasts don't email you angrily saying, why are you destroying a classic bike, which tends to happen if you're doing something like a BMW old R series. So yeah, I think he's done a really good job. What more can you say?
Smashed it. Congratulations to Sebastian Vernaison of France for a brilliant build. Many thanks for listening today, everybody, and we'll be back next week with another episode. Do leave your comments, like I say, and we'll pick through the best of them. Also, you can listen on audio only in your favourite podcasting app. Conversely, mate, if you are listening and you want to see our faces and some visuals of the bikes we're talking about, head over to YouTube and search for us. Again, many thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.
Bye-bye.